Good morning. Greetings in the name of Christ this morning. Great to be with you again. That song is an interesting counterpoint to what I'm planning on talking about this morning. Talking about a lot about martyrs. They bowed their necks, the death to feel. Met the tyrant's brandished steel, the lion's gory mane. How does God want his people to feel about serving him? We talk about our Christian duty, and we should. We talk about our duty to live all the law, or not, we don't say the law, but live all the commandments of God, to do what he wants us to do. How should we feel about that? Does God care how we feel about that? Or does he say, isn't it enough that I'm saving you eternally? Isn't that good enough for you? Just tough it out. Is that what he says? The Son of God goes forth to war. His blood-red banner streams afar. Who best can drink his cup of woe, triumphant over pain? All those things I think are important, but where does that leave us? Long, long time ago, there was an old man. Old man was climbing a mountain. Not very many trees in the mountain. It wasn't like one of our Rocky Mountains out west. It was a red mountain. Scrubby little trees on it. It was hot, sandy, rocky. He was an old man, a really old man. He was older than Brother Dan. But he had a little boy walking beside him. It was his boy. And he says, pride and joy. He's a boy that God had promised him years and years, decades before he was born. He says, I'm going to give you a boy someday. And this boy is going to be the beginning of a nation. He's going to be the start of something great. And it's going to come to the point where everybody who ever lives is going to be blessed because of you and because of this boy. Abraham waited years and years and years for this boy to get here. And finally he was there. And he loved him like only a father can understand his love. And he watched over him as he grew up, took care of him. And then one day, God said, Abraham, I've got something I'd like you to do for me. And Abraham said, sure, whatever it is, I'll do it. He said, okay, I want you to take your boy up to the top of the mountain. I want you to kill him and sacrifice him to me. Abraham said, what? Abraham took Isaac. He didn't question God. He took him. And he started that long hike. And I'm sure his little boy is running along beside him, full of questions and bubbling over. And every step felt like a lifetime. How did Abraham feel about his relationship with the Lord at that point? Must have been a terrible, terrible experience. Why did God do that to Abraham? Just because he wanted to give it to him? Just to put him in his place? Why did he do that to him? He finally got up there, you know the story, they got to the top of that mountain. Isaac said, okay, we've got everything all set up for sacrifice, but where's the lamb? He must have just killed Abraham to say, God's going to provide a lamb. And he took his son, and he bound him, and he put him on top of that altar, and he raised his knife to kill him. And God said, stop, stop, I know that you love me. Now I know that you'll do anything for me. But why did God do that to Abraham? If God loved him, why did he? Have you ever gone through an Abraham experience where you felt like God is taking the best thing in your life and tearing it out? Why does God do that to us? There was another person years and years ago, little girl, orphan girl, grew up in a way that nobody should ever have to, without her parents. But she had a cousin who took care of her, an older cousin, and he taught her as best he could, did a pretty good job at it. This little girl grew up, and one day, long story, but one day she became queen. She became queen of a land, and it came into her power through circumstances to do either do something good at great risk to herself, or to do absolutely nothing and stay in safety. And Esther went back, and I'm sure she talked to the Lord about it. And finally she defied protocol, risked her life, and went into the king. And the story is long, but she risked her life for a people that she could have let go without any personal cost to herself, that she would have known about anyway. But she put others before herself. And in so doing, by the time the story ended, you see, by putting others ahead of herself, she herself was saved. She would have never been saved if she hadn't put others first. There's another man. I'd like to read in Ecclesiastes 2. First 11 verses. This man was a wise man. The Bible says he was the wisest on the face of the earth. An incredibly smart and talented and intellectual man. Ecclesiastes 2, I said in mine heart, go to now, I will provide thee with mirth, therefore enjoy pleasure. And behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of mirth, what doeth it? I sought in mine heart to give myself unto wine, yet acquainting mine heart with wisdom, and to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was that good for the sons of God, of men, which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. I made me great works, I built me houses, I planted me vineyards, I made me gardens and orchards, and I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruits. I made me pools of water, to water therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. It got me servants and maidens, and had servants born in my house. I also had great possessions of great and small cattle, above all that were in Jerusalem before me. I gathered me also silver and gold, and the peculiar treasures of kings and of the provinces. I got me men singers and women singers, and the delights of the sons of men, as musical instruments, and that of all sorts. So I was great, and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. And whatsoever mine heart eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was the portion of all my labor. What a contrast to that old man stumbling up the mountain. What a contrast to that young Hebrew girl finding herself in a situation beyond her control and far above her head. She's in deep water, and she doesn't know what to do. We've got somebody that knows what he's doing. And he's out to have a life that brings pleasure to himself, that he can come to the end of life and say, this is what I did. Look at what I did. And this is what he has. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and in all the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun." Do you think Abraham would have said the same thing? Do you think Esther would have said the same thing? Where do we find ourselves? What are we striving for? What are we working for? What's important in our lives? What makes me cry? What makes me laugh? What hurts me? What buoys me up? Who wants to be happy? Who wants to die fulfilled? Who wants real fulfillment from this human experience that we call life? Who wants to be filled rather than empty? And how do we go about it? One of the things I think is beautiful about children's songs is that they have such huge and important truths wrapped up in little catchy tunes and short phrases. I'd like to sing a song, and let's talk about it. Let's sing J-O-Y. J-O-Y, J-O-Y, J-O-Y must be. Jesus first, yourself last, and others in between. J-O-Y, J-O-Y, J-O-Y must be. Jesus first, yourself last, and others in between. Okay, not to take us on a too wide circle here, but that's what it's all about. When we get that right, when we put the Lord first, when we put others ahead of ourselves, and our relationships are built on that, and our Christian and our life experiences are built on that, we will have joy. It doesn't matter if we're experiencing what happened in that song that we sang just before I got up, and you're asked to give your life for the Lord in a very physical way, you're asked to die for Him. It doesn't matter if you're just facing problems with somebody that you're working with, that you're dealing with every day. You're going to have joy as long as you follow that formula and put the Lord above all else and others ahead of yourself. Sometimes we view our relationships with each other merely as impediments to God. I could get so close to God if it wasn't for her. She is just in my face all the time. Or I could have peace. And I've been really enjoying this study on the fruit of the Spirit. We have these beautiful words describing what the Christian life should be: love, joy, peace, long suffering. And we had a good discussion on gentleness. Well, I could have gentleness if it wasn't that He just always brings out the worst in me. He just gets my goat. And seems like He just pushes my buttons and I. And we view each other as impediments. And our relationships with each other as impediments to God. Well, it is true that we can have a profound impact on each other. I can affect how easy your life is, and you can affect how easy mine is. But it's also true that our relationships with each other are inextricably linked with our relationship with God. And it's also true that they're an indicator of what our relationship is with God at this point. Do a tally of your relationships, and you'll see, to some degree, a picture of where you are with God right now. We're responsible to each other. We're responsible not only to those we know, but we're also responsible to those we don't know. And that's a scary thought to me. There's a lot of potential here in this room. A lot of it will never be realized. And a lot of it will be other people's faults, but that's something that you can't ever pass the blame on to somebody else. But potential is a two-edged sword. And you've got all these young men and young women up here, and there is huge potential. There's intellectual and spiritual potential here, organizational potential. There's potential for great things. John Wesley once said, "Give me 100 men that fear nothing but God and hate nothing but sin, and I will shake the very foundations of hell. You know, those 12 men, or 11 men, that came stumbling out of that room after the Lord's Supper. Those weak men, faulty men, whose potential Christ saw, soon got the reputation of being the men that turned the world upside down. There's potential here. But like I said, potential is a two-edged sword. And we can let our potential go to waste. And I say our potential, God's potential. We can let that go to waste. And somebody can say, well, 30 years later, he had so much potential. What went wrong? And potential basically becomes a negative rather than a positive. What went wrong? You know, we've got an immense opportunity to build each other up. And the way we relate to each other can have a big impact in how that potential is either realized or not realized. Now, I do want to be understood, you're responsible for your decisions. I don't care if you grow up in a home with horrible parents. You are responsible for your decisions. I don't care if you've got peer pressure that's pushing you the wrong direction. You are responsible for your decisions. You and you alone are going to heaven if you triumph over tough things and make a decision for the Lord. Decision to build your life around salvation offered by Christ. The decision to take up your cross, reject the world, and follow him. The decision to hold to God's word and live in obedience to it, even if it doesn't feel good. There's some things we have to admit. We just say, why does it have to be that way? Our flesh does. Am I willing to give it up and let the Lord have me completely? We're responsible to make the right decision. If you make the wrong decisions, you're going to pay. I don't care if you were in a group of friends that all pushed you the wrong way, you're going to pay. I don't care if your parents weren't what they should have been and it made it hard for you to make the right decisions, you are going to pay. We're going to pay for our own decisions. And sometimes we stop right there and we say, well, that's, you know, we see somebody over there and we say, well, I just thank God that I'm not like him. It's a nice platform. We say, well, I'm responsible for the decisions that I made and look where I am. I've come out where I should be. And he could have made the right decision. It was in his power. He didn't. And we wash our hands of him. We go our way, patting ourselves on the back. Pleased that we're God's people. Happy that we, unlike some other people we could name, are taking up the cross, rejecting the world, and reaping the rewards of good decisions. We don't think about the fact that a lot of these decisions were made a long time before we were ever born by people that we don't even know the names to. What does God think of this? It's one of those things, where I said things that we say doesn't make us comfortable. But this is what God thinks of it. If you turn to Ezekiel 33, it says, again the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, speak to the children of thy people, and say unto them, when I bring the sword upon a land, if the people of the land take a man of their coasts and set him for their watchman, if, when he seeth the sword come upon the land, he blow the trumpet and warn the people, then whosoever heareth the sound of the trumpet and taketh not warning, if the sword come and take him away, his blood shall be upon his own head. He heard the sound of the trumpet and took not warning. His blood shall be upon him. But he that taketh warning shall deliver his soul. But if the watchman see the sword come and blow not the trumpet, and the people be not warned, if the sword come and take any person away from them, take any person from among them, he is taken away in his iniquity. He's going to pay. He's going to die. But his blood will I require at the watchman's hand. So thou, O son of man, I have set thee a watchman unto the house of Israel. Therefore, thou shalt hear the word at my mouth and warn them from me. When I say unto the wicked, O wicked man, thou shalt surely die. If thou dost not speak to warn the wicked from his way, that wicked man shall die in his iniquity. but his blood will I require at thine hand. Nevertheless, if thou warn the wicked of his way to turn from it, if he do not turn from his way, he shall die in his iniquity, but thou hast delivered thy soul. James 4, verse 17 says it this way, therefore, to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, it is sin. That make you feel good? Doesn't make me feel good either. Sort of hurts. Remember what I said about potential? Potential being a two-edged weapon? We've got so much opportunity. We're not going to be judged just by what we did, but by what we should have done. Am I willing to look at that straight in the face? It's not about me. It's about God. When we get to that point, when we say, it's not about me, it's about you, Lord, whatever it takes, then we're on the right road. Self-centeredness is a vacuum that can never be filled. And it'll lead you to a profound emptiness of spirit. Cynicism. Bitterness toward those around you who aren't doing enough for you. I'd like to look over here in if I can find it. Matthew 25, verses 31 through 46. When the Son of Man shall come in his glory, and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory, and before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divideth his sheep from the goats, and he shall set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. Then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was an hungered, and ye gave me meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me. Then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee an hungered, and fed thee, or thirsty, and gave thee drink? When saw we thee a stranger, and took thee in, or naked, and clothed thee? Or when saw we thee sick, or in prison, and came unto thee? And the king shall answer, and say unto them, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto the one of the least of these, my brethren, ye have done it unto me. Then shall I say also unto them on the left hand, depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was an hungered, and ye gave me no meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me not in. Naked, and ye clothed me not. Sick, and in prison, and ye visited me not. Then shall they say also unto him, then they also answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee an hungered, or a thirst, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister unto thee? Then shall he answer them, saying, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye did it not to one of the least of these, ye did it not to me. And these shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into life eternal. What do we have to do to be saved? Okay, it's a bit of a trick question. When we do something often enough for the right reason, I shouldn't say that. When we do something often enough, I think we can say that just it's the way it is, because if we do it often enough, it becomes, it says something about us. But when we do something to the point where we don't think about it anymore, it becomes part of who we are and no longer just something that we do. These people that Jesus talked to had no idea of the things that they were doing simply because it was a part of them. Some of them ignored needs because that was who they were. They never even stopped to look at them. Other people took care of needs around them and didn't even realize that's what they were doing because that's who they were. The same is true of us. What kind of a person am I? It's beyond the things that I do and into who I am. When we put each other first, when our relationships are built around Christ, and we put others first, it becomes a part of who we are, and no longer just something we do. And I think it's important that as Christians, our relationships are centered on Christ. It's like I read in a book once about couples. It said that we view lovers as being face to face. They're looking at each other. And that's really what they're consumed with, looking at each other, getting to know each other, wanting to know everything about you. And you know that those things are very important. But a sign of a truly good relationship is when it's no longer facing in, but as a team facing the same direction. And that's what our relationships should be as brothers and sisters, is that we are a team. We're not interested only in each other. We are, but we have moved past that, and we are now a team. We're looking the same direction. That's what Christ does when Christ is in our relationships. An essential part of relationships is the ability to forgive. And we just finished quoting the Lord's Prayer, in which we've said, "Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors." Am I willing to actually feel that? Am I willing to forgive you to the extent that I want God to forgive me? It's an essential. There's a beautiful passage that Christ says when he's talking about how we are supposed to relate to each other. And it says, let's just see here. I often when I start studying, I look I let verses just come into my mind that I think apply, and I start writing them down. And I told Eunice that the hardest part is sometimes not saying, knowing what to say, but what not to say. And I didn't do a terribly good job of filtering this out because I ended up with a lot more than I can possibly say, or read, actually, is what I should say, because I ended up with about 11 pages of scriptures. But Christ, let me see. Luke 6, verse 24 to 38 is where this is found. Starts out with pronouncing a woe. "Woe unto you that are rich, for ye have received your consolation. Woe unto you that are full, for ye shall hunger. Woe unto you that laugh now, for ye shall mourn and weep. Woe unto you when all men shall speak well of you, for so did their fathers to the false prophets. But I say unto you which hear, love your enemies, do good to them which hate you, bless them that curse you, and pray for them which despitefully use you. And to him that smiteth thee on the one cheek, offer also the other. And him that taketh away thy cloak, forbid not to take thy coat also. Give to every man that asketh of thee, and of him that taketh away thy goods, ask them not again. And as ye would that men should do to you, do ye also to them likewise. For if ye love them which love you, what thank have ye? For sinners also love those that love them. And if ye do good to them which do good to you, what thank have ye? For sinners also do even the same. And if ye lend to them which ye hope to receive, what thank have you? For sinners also lend to sinners to receive as much again. But love ye your enemies, and do good, and lend, hoping for nothing again. And your reward shall be great, and ye shall be the children of the highest, for he is kind unto the unthankful and to the evil. Be therefore merciful, as your Father also is merciful. Judge not, and ye shall not be judged. Condemn not, and ye shall not be condemned. Forgive, and ye shall be forgiven." Sounds like a recipe for disaster, doesn't it? When somebody comes to you and asks for something, you just give it. It's just all about give, give, give. And what about me? Where am I in all this? Who's going to watch out for me? And old Solomon jumps back up in the back of our mind and says, "Well, I would like that or that. Got to save that up for that." And we say, "Well, surely there's, I'll take care of my little pet over here, and then we'll see about if we've got enough left over to help somebody." Like I said, it sounds like a recipe for disaster. But what does Jesus say? Verse 38, "It shall be give, and it shall be given unto you. Good measure, pressed down and shaken together and running over, shall men give into your bosom. For with the same measure ye meet withal, it shall be measured to you again." Now, mark that it's not It doesn't work if you say, well, I'm going to give so that people will give to me. I'm going to be a generous person so that people will be generous with me. It doesn't work that way. That's called manipulation. And people soon scent that, and that's the end of that. This has to be who we are. When we reach that point where we are giving because that's who we are and because of our relationship with the Lord, at that point, God can do a great work in our lives. And I would just encourage you to let God be center in our relationships. And to answer my question about Abraham, why did God do that to Abraham? Why did God do that to Esther? Put them in those tragic situations and test them so strongly. Was it just to give them a hard time? Why did he do it? Why does he do it to us? It's because he loves us. And it's because sometimes we're awfully blind and we need our eyes opened. And he has a hard time getting our eyes opened. And so he opens them in ways that maybe we wouldn't have chosen ourselves, but after they're open, they say, thank you, God, for doing that to me. Does God want us to be miserable? Absolutely not. There's a passage in 1 Chronicles, I believe, where it talks about the fact that God was going to send people into captivity if they didn't serve him with gladness of heart. It's part of what he wants from his people is joyfulness. Is that going to be just part of the drudgery? One of the by the dots things that we have to do? We have to obey God. We have to be joyful. Otherwise, we're going to be punished. Absolutely not. Because if we do things God's way, if we truly put him first, put others ahead of ourselves, and ourselves last, that is the surest recipe for a happy life, for a life that's fulfilled, for a life that is really in tune with God. And there's no better place than that place. Let's stand for prayer.